Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and physical therapy pearls of wisdom to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is really to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in. Real quick before we dive in, I am just so incredibly proud of this really huge community of movers in the Barefoot Mini Course that are just excited to learn over these next 2 weeks. And today we actually have a private Zoom with functional podiatrist Dr. Emily, and she's going to answer a ton of questions for the community. That's tonight. Now, this is your last opportunity to get into this course. So if you have been struggling with something like plantar fasciitis, pain with bunions, you're not understanding why you're getting that random heel pain, or you maybe suffer from shin splints, Achilles pain, any of these foot issues, or you feel like you might be prone to developing them. Maybe you've seen your mom or your parents kind of suffer with some foot issues. We don't want to fall into that, right? So taking care of our feet is really going to help us all the way up our chain, because how are we squatting? How are we walking? How are we moving? Really affects our knees, our hips, our back. So getting a grip on this foot health is going to be so key. So I hope you join. We're going to drop the link right below, or you can just go to docgenfit.com/barefoot and come join our mini course. I am so excited for our next guest, Lily Nichols, who is a registered dietitian nutritionist, certified diabetes educator, researcher, and author with a passion for evidence-based prenatal nutrition. Her work is known for being research-focused, thorough, and critical of outdated dietary guidelines. She's the co-founder of the Women's Health Nutrition Academy and author of 2 books, Real Food for Pregnancy, which I own, and Real Food for Gestational Diabetes. Lily's best-selling books have helped tens of thousands of mamas and babies and are used in university-level maternal nutrition and midwifery courses, and have even influenced prenatal nutrition policy internationally. She writes more at lilynicholsrdn.com, where she has a ton of blogs where you can learn a lot more information about her and what she does. So excited to get into this interview with her. Lily, thank you so, so much for being here and just taking time to be on our podcast and be able to fill us with your incredible information and research that you have devoted to your own career. I just really appreciate you being here. I'm truly obsessed with your stuff.
Aww. Well, thank you.
And I know that you have 2 incredible books, first of all, that I just want to throw out there, Real Food for Pregnancy, which I have, and then Real Food for Gestational Diabetes. And what made you go down this route of, you know, getting into really understanding pregnancy health for nutrition?
Well, it's a little bit on purpose and a little bit by accident. So really early in my interest in nutrition, which I would say started in like my teen years, I was introduced to the work of Dr. Weston Price via Sally Fallon's book, Nourishing Traditions. At the time, I was like vegetarian, so obviously my diet has changed a lot over the years. Mm. And that was where I was first introduced to this concept that preconception health had anything to do with pregnancy outcomes, the development of the baby. I mean, beyond like the standard stuff, right? But knowing that there could be sort of this generational impact of nutrition and learning about how traditional cultures like emphasized certain foods, preconception, and really made an effort back in the day when there were no prenatal vitamins or any like backup source of nutrition. It was all like what you were eating, and still kind of in like, you're talking about communities that don't have access to modern medical care, right? It's a survival of the fittest kind of a situation. And so they really emphasized preconception and pregnancy and postpartum nutrition, actually for both partners, maybe not the the postpartum stuff for the man, but certainly for the woman. And it wasn't until I had like finished my training as a dietitian, like finished my internship and was working, I had the opportunity to work with the California Diabetes and Pregnancy Program, also known as Sweet Success. And that's where things kind of came full circle. I started learning about the impact of blood sugar management during pregnancy on pregnancy outcomes, and also the development of the baby, like the pancreas and your metabolism is really being imprinted during pregnancy, and that has a lifetime impact on that child's risk of developing diabetes or later becoming obese or having metabolic syndrome. So, you know, it can be an anywhere from like a 6 to 19-fold increased risk of type 2 diabetes for children born to mothers that have poor blood sugar control during pregnancy. And that was like,
wow,
light bulb moment for me. I had thought that maybe I would focus my career on improving childhood nutrition because we had like the, you know, childhood obesity epidemic going on and like diabetes being diagnosed in toddlers even, you know, the type of diabetes that had previously only been diagnosed in adults. So it was like, whoa, these metabolic diseases are starting way earlier than they should be. And to understand that there could be a prenatal nutrition component that could also address that, it was kind of a two birds with one stone situation. Like, wow, if we can improve mom's health, we could improve baby's development and really their lifetime health. So that's where it all started. In terms of the books, you know, my first book, Real Food for Gestational Diabetes, was really a response to what I saw in clinical practice, which was that the guidelines, which ironically I had worked on, didn't work very well in real life practice with clients. And oftentimes their blood sugar control got worse when they were following, you know, the standard dietary recommendations. So that led me to start digging deeper into some of the issues with like, how were the prenatal nutrition guidelines set? How were the carbohydrate recommendations set for pregnancy? Does it make sense? Can you go lower carb? What if we, you know, up the protein or change the ratios of this and that? That really got me going. And so Real Food for Gestational Diabetes was a response to just the woefully inadequate dietary guidelines for gestational diabetes. And Real Food for Pregnancy came a few years after that, after my first pregnancy. Just in, you start looking at all the other nutrients, like, okay, let's go into the protein, let's go into the fat, let's go into the vitamin B12, let's go into the choline. And you start to see so many gaps in the nutrition guidelines for pregnancy. A lot of things are just built on estimates of nutrient requirements. They're not really, we don't have a whole lot of data in pregnancy specifically. So a lot of it is a giant guesstimate. And in my opinion, we can do so much more to have better pregnancy outcomes by really emphasizing, especially our micronutrients, vitamins and minerals, and then kind of, you know, you let the cards fall where they may for macronutrients, and it's like everything is better, you know, like risk of pregnancy complications, improvements in baby's brain development, birth outcomes, postpartum recovery, breastfeeding, those things can all be improved with a better focus on nutrient density in prenatal nutrition and arguably all the way back to preconception as well.
Wow.
Wow. I'm still, my mind's still blown about the kind of what you mentioned with the generational impact of blood sugar and how I think it was like 6 to 19 fold increase in risk of developing type 2 diabetes. So what I would wonder is, what are some of the things that you thought when you kind of look back at historic guidelines that may have been a little outdated? Because I know that you mentioned a lot about how a lot of the advice we get, it's just outdated and people haven't been looking at the newer research or new information that we're getting. And what are some of the strategies now that you educate mamas in or mamas to be or people thinking about getting pregnant that will help start to bring that blood sugar into more of a regulated space? Because I know that I have a sister-in-law who through all four of her pregnancies was either just on the edge of or always kind of in that gestational diabetes category. And she did everything she possibly could. And she was going on walks after every meal. She was avoiding any simple carbohydrate. She was like everything she possibly could. And in her later pregnancies, she kept it under pretty decent control. But I kind of want to get an idea of what are some of those strategies that you educate people in?
Well, some of that can have to do with maybe the dietary information that she had been provided in earlier pregnancies, and she had adapted over time to like rein that in a little bit, figure out what actually works.
Yeah,
So she talks sometimes about that's that. You know, guidelines working against you. Interesting though, because usually over time, you know, in subsequent pregnancies, you're also older, and age works against you with insulin resistance, right? You just tend to become more insulin resistant, more prone to high blood sugar the older you get. So the fact that she had improvements over time is interesting, right? They're also, in terms of just to go back to, like, you have somebody who's doing everything right and they still have gestational diabetes. It's like the $1 million question if we could prevent it with something. There's lots of potential strategies that could go into it, but also to go back to this discussion about kids and the higher risk of type 2 diabetes, most of us having children now are kids of like the, you know, 80s and 90s, right? And that was at the time where we had the implementation of the low-fat dietary guidelines. You know, the Snackwells low-fat cookies that are just like pure refined carbs and sugar, but it's low fat, right? And yeah. So a lot of us were born to mothers who were eating a really high carb diet because that's what was considered healthy at the time. And that's really what the food industry was trying to cater towards. And that impacts your pancreas. And so it's not only a higher risk of type 2 diabetes, but it could be a higher risk of gestational diabetes as well. Because pregnancy is like the ultimate stress test on your body, including your blood sugar regulating systems. So if your pancreas isn't at like 100% optimal, even if you have really good insulin resistance, you're really fit, you, you know, eat pretty well, you move your body, you're not overweight, the pancreas can have trouble maybe coping with the increased needs for insulin. Like it has to pump out 2 to 3 fold more insulin over the course of pregnancy. So if there's something that was like disrupted in pancreatic development in utero, it was kind of overused maybe because our moms were eating such a high carb diet and having such high blood sugars, then that can actually manifest itself in pregnancy. So just going to throw that out there that sometimes there's factors that just aren't within your control. And then you do just have to deal with it as best you can, which it sounds like she was able to do, and able to do possibly better over the course of time as she kind of learned in previous pregnancies what worked and keep implementing what she's learned.
Well, it was funny because she even talked about, you know, she, I think it was either her second or third, and she did go with a dietitian from the hospital who told her, no, you have to eat this many carbs. I don't know what the limit was when, you know, she was getting that information, but she said she just felt like it wasn't good for her body. And so her last pregnancy, she basically cut out all carbs and focus, and she didn't need any insulin. And she really just focused on what she felt fueled her body best and what she felt worked best for her. And she was able to manage it so, so well.
And clarifying, like all of those simple carbohydrates, she ate a lot more like the complex vegetables and stuff like that. Right. So she was still getting carbohydrate in.
Right.
But they did a home birth as well. So she didn't take any medication. She went completely to the opposite end of the spectrum in her last pregnancy, after being on medication in the previous three. I think it's pretty amazing. Like you say, how it gets more difficult with time.
And now, so just to circle back to your original question, like both what can be done to, you know, manage blood sugar better in pregnancy, and then what are the gaps in the guidelines? I mean, this leads right into it. So, you know, the carbohydrate guidelines, all the macronutrient guidelines are just a hot mess for pregnancy, in my opinion. They really are an extrapolation of the standard for all Americans dietary guidelines, which also are not built on that solid of evidence. But they are extrapolated from that. So our standard dietary guidelines are for a high carb diet, like 45 to 65% of our calories coming from carbohydrates. Limit your fat intake, you know, eat X amount of protein, which is like a bare minimum level, by the way. And make sure it's all lean, cut out all the fat off of it, low fat dairy products, take out the egg yolks, like, you know, lean, you know, chicken breast with the skin taken off and only lean cuts of beef, right? That's the same advice really that's given for pregnancy. And it's a mismatch, in my opinion, for what the body actually needs during pregnancy. So what you're describing your sister-in-law doing in, you know, this final pregnancy really echoes what I cover in Real Food for Gestational Diabetes, which is like, okay, in this situation, we're responding to like this immediate need to bring blood sugar into balance. And the guidelines for pregnancy suggest that same amount of carbohydrates I already mentioned, but certainly no less than a mandatory minimum of 175 grams of carbohydrates per day.
Wow.
And you split that into meals and think back to, you know, how they actually diagnose gestational diabetes, which is usually with something called a glucose tolerance test, where they give you a sugary beverage that has a specific amount of glucose, and then they measure your blood sugar response, typically before and after. And you look at the amount that's given in a glucose tolerance test, it's anywhere from 50, 75 to 100 grams, depending on which one your office is using or which combination of them they're using. And then you look at the breakdown of 175 grams of carbs split over meals and snacks. I mean, if you're going to be eating 45 to 60 grams of carbohydrates at a meal, who in the right mind would expect that you would have really good blood sugar numbers after you so-called failed this glucose test with that same amount of carbohydrates? Sure, it's not all, you know, pure sugar that you're having at your meal, but it just doesn't make like toddler logic. It doesn't make sense. And it also just doesn't work. So you look at the data on especially like lower glycemic carbohydrates. So like you were saying, she was doing more like vegetables than, you know, fresh produce than, you know, legumes and things like that. These whole food carbohydrate sources that have fiber and other micronutrients built in versus white flour, white sugar carbohydrates, you see a significant reduction, like 50% reduction in the need for insulin in pregnancies where you emphasize low glycemic carbohydrates over the simple carbohydrates. Likewise, the same goes for when you look at data, even in women without gestational diabetes. You take healthy pregnant women in the third trimester and you give them a CGM, a continuous glucose monitor, and you give them a high glycemic diet or a low glycemic diet, even if they have the same amount of carbs, by the way. And you see a 50% reduction in blood sugar variability on the low glycemic plan. So certainly our carbohydrate guidelines are ones that definitely need to be revised. So there really is no good evidence that you need 175 grams of carbohydrates minimum in pregnancy. Devote a whole chapter to that in Real Food for Gestational Diabetes. And when you reduce the carbohydrates and consume better quality carbohydrates, typically you're eating more of other things, especially your protein-rich foods. And that naturally has the consequence of increasing the amount of vitamins and minerals, or in other words, the nutrient density of your diet. Protein also does not spike your blood sugar. Likewise, fat doesn't spike your blood sugar. So you see significantly better blood sugar responses and like lower variability in your blood sugar. So fewer spikes and crashes when people are eating more protein and fat and a slightly lesser quantity of carbohydrates and better quality carbohydrates. So that's really what I advocate for. It's not really that extreme when you look at it, but for some people who've been really conditioned to, you know, have to have like a large serving of grains at every meal, like having bread or a pasta or a rice or something like that at every single meal, and who also usually are trying to restrict the amount of fat they eat, it can feel like a big change, you know? But really, you know, we're talking about just sort of shifting ratios and then thinking about like the quality of the foods that are consumed.
Yeah. And I love, well, we did a CGM actually a couple months ago, and that was really, really fascinating to be able to see, even especially in the morning. And I love that you did, you just recently did a blog post about, you know, the, what was it? The Tale of Two Breakfasts.
Yeah.
And can you talk about that a little bit, and why breakfast, one, is so important to get in, especially if you're pregnant, but two, the type of pregnant of breakfast that you're getting in the morning?
Yeah. So like you, I've worn a CGM several times as well. And that breakfast meal, it's fascinating. It really sets the tone for the day. It sets the tone for your blood sugar and insulin levels for the day, for your like stress hormone responses, for the whole day, which of course also affects your blood sugar and insulin levels. So what you eat, when you eat, combination of foods does play a significant role in just your quality of life. And then overall, also your nutrient intake. People who eat breakfast tend to just eat a more balanced, nutrient-dense diet than people who skip breakfast. Mm. Usually if you skip breakfast, then by the time you eat, you're super hungry and you're usually not going for the best of food choices. And then you tend to overeat later in the day, leading to higher blood sugar, like right before you go to sleep, just at the time when your metabolism wants to like take a rest and go to sleep, right? So I know it like goes against all the intermittent fasting arguments, but if you are going to do something like that, and this is outside of the context of pregnancy, front load your food at the beginning of the day and just have a lighter dinner or something like that, or a very early dinner, instead of skipping breakfast. It really seems to blunt your metabolism, and especially for women, can lead to a bunch of problems with hormone levels. It can really tank your hormone levels. So I have a lot of women who have been doing intermittent fasting for a long time, and then they end up like amenorrheic or with some weird blood sugar stuff or a lot of adrenal issues. Thyroid issues, slows your thyroid down. So I'm personally a fan of breakfast. I know, take it or leave it, but I am a fan of breakfast. As far as what you break the fast with, it seems that after a long period of fasting, i.e. overnight, like you haven't eaten usually while you've slept, then by the morning time, your body is like much more sensitive to carbohydrates and other times of day. I don't know if you noticed this when you did CGM, but like if you break your fast in the morning with oatmeal or just fruit or like a fruit smoothie or something like that versus having oatmeal or smoothie, fruit juice or something later in the day, the blood sugar spike is significantly higher versus having a protein meal first thing in the day.
Oh yeah.
So I tend to see that response with most people that I work with, certainly not all. We're all individuals, and that's why using a CGM on your own can be interesting. But what I've observed is having a significant amount of protein at breakfast, and depending on your size and activity levels, this might be like 20 grams of protein, 30, 40 grams of protein at breakfast with the source of fat that usually it naturally comes with. Like if you're having eggs, they have yolks that have fat and you're probably cooking it in some fat, like maybe some butter. And then pairing that, usually a lot of people can have some carbs in the morning as long as it's not the only thing. So for me, I usually will have like with a piece of homemade sourdough bread or maybe some fruit or maybe some like cooked sweet potatoes left over from dinner the night before. That leads me with like a really stable blood sugar response to breakfast. So it might, my blood sugar might go up like 10 or 15 points, but it's basically like a flat line. Mm-hmm. It just, it's very gentle rise, very gentle fall. It keeps you satiated for a long period of time. So you don't have those mid-morning munchies or that like craving for caffeine to like pick you up because you're feeling so tired. It really keeps you stable and full. And when your blood sugar is stabilized then and not crashing, you're not as hungry as quickly. And by the time lunch rolls around, you're not so famished that you like your stomach is growling and you're like clawing at the door needing to eat a piece of fruit like while the meal is cooking. Like usually your blood sugar isn't crashing quickly. It's still relatively stable. So you just have this sort of gentle gnawing to have some food, and you have some food and go about your day. But if you start the morning with something like oatmeal, and I've done this a number of times with CGM, I've done it without adding a source of fat and protein as our dietary guidelines. A lot of the sample meal plans will be like oatmeal, low fat milk, and like berries or something. And hey, nothing against like any of those foods, but when it's all of them in combination and there's no fat or protein to balance it out, you get a really big blood sugar spike. So even somebody like myself, like I'm at a healthy weight, like really no health issues, everything's good. All markers of blood sugar and insulin resistance are really squarely in the normal range. I have a 100-point spike to a breakfast of oatmeal, milk, and berries. I tried in my most recent CGM experiment to combine it with protein. So I added it was a beef protein isolate. So it added about 12 grams of protein to the oatmeal, which equated to about the same amount of protein as two eggs. And it still spiked my blood sugar a lot, like about 60 points. Whereas I already just described with an egg breakfast with a slightly lower amount of carbs, but a lot more protein, is fine. Even a smaller breakfast with an equal amount of protein, but like half the amount of carbohydrates, blood sugar, totally fine. So think about this with the type of foods that most of us aim for at breakfast. I mean, it's very typical, I would say, at least in a modern American diet to have cereal or oatmeal or a bagel or a piece of toast or a glass of juice or a smoothie that's made with like all fruit and milk or all fruit and juice. And to think of that as like, that counts as breakfast. Sure, it does, but it's all carbohydrates. It's going to give you a really significant blood sugar spike and a really significant crash. And without even wearing a CGM, you can usually identify that that's happening if you find yourself hungry within an hour or an hour and a half of eating a meal. That's usually a sign, A, you completely underate, or B, you had a big blood sugar spike and crash. So if you have crazy mid-morning cravings, especially for carbs or caffeine, or you're starving by the time you get to lunch and like you get lightheaded or have headaches or just feel lousy and low energy, probably a sign that you want to be thinking about getting more protein at breakfast.
Yeah.
I think Jen and I both went through our own CGM tragedies when we, because Jen enjoyed having a bagel.
It was a gluten-free bagel.
Gluten-free bagel sandwich that she would have. And I'm a smoothie bowl fiend. And so, yeah, both of us, after our first bagel and smoothie bowl respectively, saw the massive spike and then drama, tragedy in that moment. But then, kind of like you said, I think the important thing is you don't have to go without those things, and you don't have to completely cut these things out, as long as we maybe do a little reordering and just a little bit of portion adjusting. And then Jen decided, okay, I'm just going to have some eggs and some chorizo and some, you know, arugula, and then I'll have the bagel after that, you know?
Exactly. And have the bagel, or maybe it's half a bagel, like an hour or so after your breakfast or mid-morning snack, or even at lunch. And oftentimes it's fine. It's like that breakfast meal is really tricky.
Oh, yeah. It made a huge difference.
Yeah. So seeing those differences, it almost empowers you more to just start making slightly different changes, but still eating the things that you enjoy. And so I something's sticking with me that you said earlier about these different cultures or cultures that still exist, that you said like they aren't the same as the American society, the pill popping society, where we're always just looking for the multivitamin or the pill that's going to get the nutrients in. You mentioned that there are these natural foods out there that people are just eating, whether it's prenatal or during first, second, third trimester. So what are some of your foods that are kind of the natural multivitamins that you encourage people to eat during each stage of pregnancy?
Yeah. Well, and no shade against, you know, prenatal vitamins. I think they're, you know, a good insurance policy, but
for sure,
ultimately they're a new thing. We didn't always have that insurance policy to fall back on. So where did we get those nutrients if we weren't getting it from a supplement? And there's a lot of foods that are incredibly nutrient dense. Actually, I'm going to have a research brief coming out on my Instagram sometime soon about some research studies. It's not just me saying it, but they've actually looked at what are the most nutrient dense foods on the planet that meet some of these requirements for critical nutrients, especially for women of reproductive age and young children. And it circles back to the same kind of foods that I emphasize in Real Food for Pregnancy. So I have a chapter on nutrient dense foods that are really supportive of prenatal health. And that includes things like eggs with the yolks. So we've already talked about that. Breakfast would be a great time to get those in.
Yeah.
But great source of protein, balances your blood sugar, really high in a lot of micronutrients, including things like choline. We can go into that if you want to. DHA, a number of fat soluble vitamins like vitamins A and E, and a fair amount of minerals as well, like selenium and iodine and other things. So eggs definitely are on the list. I think they're way underappreciated for their nutritional value. Most of those micronutrients are in the yolk, so you do want to eat the yolk. And as far as things like choline, which is really, really important, like throughout pregnancy, but especially in early pregnancy, choline plays a role in the prevention of neural tube defects, just like folate. So everybody emphasizes folate and people are taking their folate supplements and nobody thinks about choline. It works in like that same pathway of preventing neural tube defects. And eggs are our number one source of choline. Another food that's definitely on the list would be liver and organ meats. This is a controversial one because a lot of people have been told to avoid liver in pregnancy, ironically, because they're concerned about too much vitamin A. I debunk that myth in the book. I also now have a blog article on liver and organ meats on my website that goes through some of this. And liver, arguably, is the most nutrient-dense food on the planet. So yes, it's rich in vitamin A, and no, natural vitamin A is not linked to birth defects in the way that synthetic high-dose vitamin A supplements are, just to give you a little hint of what I cover in that article. But you also get really high amounts of choline, vitamin B12, iron, zinc, selenium, folate. I mean, liver is actually the richest source of folate. Everybody thinks leafy greens. I got nothing against leafy greens, but actually liver is richer in folate than your leafy greens. But a lot of the nutrients of concern in pregnancy that either women are not getting enough of, or that women are already deficient in, or that needs increase for, like the guidelines are higher for those nutrients in pregnancy, those are really all concentrated in liver. With the vitamin A, for example, 80% of women in the U.S., this is across all socioeconomic backgrounds, don't meet the RDA for vitamin A. There's all this fear mongering about vitamin A. If you don't eat liver, there's this other study that looked at liver intake and chances of, like, what's the likelihood that people met the RDA or did not. 70% of people who didn't eat liver did not meet the RDA for vitamin A. So again, tell me why we're telling everybody to avoid liver over too much vitamin A when most women are not getting enough. It is definitely a, you know, stronger flavored food, kind of self-limiting. And so I get around like the challenges people have with incorporating it by encouraging people to either puree it or make pate and mix a small amount into their ground meat dishes. Ground meat also very nutrient dense. You can boost the nutrient density even more with liver. A few other foods that are highly nutrient dense would be your fatty fish and seafood and shellfish. Those are all rich sources of DHA, a really important omega-3 fat for baby's brain development, minerals like selenium and iodine, which support thyroid health and fetal brain development. And also for people who don't eat a lot of red meat, fish tends to fill in quite a few nutrient gaps for people who are low meat eaters, like iron and zinc and B12 and choline and other things. I could go on and on. I mean, I think dairy products, high quality dairy products fill a void. Certainly your vegetables and fresh produce and fruit also fill a void. You can make a case for virtually anything, but the ones that I've outlined already, like the eggs, the liver and organ meats, the fish, those really fill the vast majority of the nutrient gaps that are pretty common in people's diets. And ironically, these are a lot of the foods that people are kind of afraid to eat, either based on concerns that like animal foods or meat is unhealthy. Most of those claims, I believe, are unfounded, or like environmental or ethical concerns. There's really, you know, a big push towards plant-based eating. And unfortunately, that can leave a lot of nutrient gaps in the diet. So if you are looking to try to meet those nutrient needs from food alone, you can make a really strong case for those being a regular part of your diet.
I mean, those are all so, so huge. And I know that I think I heard on another podcast you talked about your meatloaf recipe that had the liver in it, right?
Yeah.
So I think we're going to have to try that one because so far Dom has not succeeded had cooking a recipe with liver in it that I've enjoyed.
Liver's tough. I eat liver straight, but
he can eat it straight up. Pâtés, everything. He eats all the things that I don't.
Make the pâté. My best advice on the liver. I probably should have specified in the recipe, because I think I say you can chop up the liver really finely. It's really hard to do that. It's much better to puree it. And in my opinion, just make a pâté that already is seasoned and tastes good. And it's some of the liquid has evaporated from it during the cooking process. So it's just easier to mix into the meatloaf. So my preference is I'll make a batch of pâté a couple times a year. I mean, nobody really likes preparing liver or the smell of it. I mean, if you grew up with it, that's one thing. And I've learned that a lot of people from other countries and other cultures have no qualms with liver. And they think it's crazy that I'm making all these recommendations about hiding liver. Why would you hide liver? It's delicious. We have it every week, you know? But most of us really didn't grow up eating a lot of it. So I make a pâté, I'll have, some servings of that, and most of it goes into the freezer in ice cube trays or 4-ounce mason jars. And then when I go to make a meatloaf, we usually do a lot of our meat from a cow share or a pig share or something like that. So it's all frozen anyway. So I'll get out, the 2 pounds of ground beef for the recipe and some pâté. Now, depending on how new you are to incorporating liver, you might just want to do 3 ounces or 4 ounces for that whole recipe. You can do more if you are used to it. But the pâté gets mixed into the whole meatloaf mixture. And when it's pâté and it's fully pureed, you already know it has some flavor, it has some seasoning because you made pâté and it tastes good. But B, it's fully pureed, so it gets mixed right into the ground meat. So you're not going to come across a chunk of liver or a part of the meatloaf that tastes stronger than the rest of it. And then I also think the tomato topping, it's a pretty thick layer of tomato, it uses a whole can of tomato paste. I think that also helps a lot with covering it up.
Yeah.
And if you're like my kids, they like ketchup with it. So they put, once we serve it, they serve it with ketchup, or my husband likes it with ranch dressing, but you just got to go for it. And sometimes it's a mind over matter issue. If you know it's in there and we've kind of built up these stories in our minds about certain foods being gross, then suddenly we can taste it. I know people who, if their partner makes something for them and doesn't tell them it has liver, then they can eat it. But if they make that same recipe themselves and they add the liver themselves, they're I just can't eat it. I can't do it. So that might be something to play around with. I don't know. You could blindside her and just stick it in the meatloaf and not let it.
It honestly is better that way.
I know. I like it though. There's layers to hiding the liver. I can see how that might work a little bit better.
How do you feel about the organ capsules and the supplements?
If that's the only way that they can get down the hatch, go for it.
Great,
that's one of the options I talk about in the liver and organ meats article. It's kind of focused around how to make it palatable. So all these different options of how to do it, from the hidden liver to finding, recipes that make it taste good, to there is a company that makes liver chips, to these, desiccated or, freeze dried liver in capsule form. In that article, I talk about sort of dosing. So every supplement company has, a different capsule size, or maybe it's an organ blend, so you don't know how much liver's in there. So if you have any concerns about, overdoing it on the liver, check out that article, because I give some ideas for how to, you want to ask them how much actual liver is in the capsule and how you can kind of equate it to a fresh serving of liver. Again, the only concern being with fresh organ meats and liver, like I said, the flavor is strong for some people and maybe an acquired taste. And so it's usually a self-limiting food. But when you bypass your taste buds and are taking it in supplemental form, you just don't want to OD on it. Mm-hmm. So, 3 to 6 ounces or so of fresh liver per week is absolutely perfectly safe. No concerns over excessive vitamin A intake. So I would aim for similar with a liver or organ meat capsule. So you just want to check on the vitamin A content of that to make sure you're not going too high in it.
Got it. Yeah, that's super helpful.
So I know that earlier in the conversation, you mentioned that you previously were vegetarian or vegan. And I know that there may be some people listening that are kind of in that boat for whatever reason. And is there a way to kind of, I guess, supplement in all these things, all these great nutrients that we can get from things that you're talking about, like eggs, liver? I know we were just talking about the organ capsules, of course. Like, do you feel like supplementing in a lot of these nutrients that somebody might generally get from more meat-based or animal-based products is possible in a vegetarian or vegan diet?
So, and yes, I was previously vegetarian, although I was not previously vegan, though I have lots of close friends and even family members who are still currently practicing vegan. So just to show that I'm not, I'm very tuned into the rationale and reasons that people continue on such a diet. With pregnancy, preconception, fertility, breastfeeding, we do have to think that, you know, these choices are not just affecting us. And they're not just affecting us like for the short period of time or however long we're on the diet, but it can have lasting consequences on the baby. So I think my biggest consideration on such a diet is first of all, the micronutrients, and looking at which micronutrients you could be not eating enough of, that you might have a long-standing deficiency in, that you might need an additional supplement for. Sometimes these are things that are technically provided in a diet, but it's not in sufficient concentrations in plant food to really make it reasonable to get all of those from food sources alone. So choline is a good example that really doesn't get as much attention as I think it should in vegetarian or vegan circles. On a vegetarian diet that includes eggs and dairy products, absolutely possible to meet the choline requirements. Like I said, eggs are really one of the most concentrated sources. Other than that, it's like liver and organ meats. So if you are a vegetarian who consumes eggs on a regular basis, like 2-3 a day, you're probably not going to have any trouble with choline. As a vegan, it gets a little bit trickier because the most concentrated sources, plant sources of choline are just not a lot of choline per serving. They're just not nearly as concentrated as eggs. So I actually had an Instagram post that went up recently. I probably should have it pulled up so I can speak directly to it. But I compared the amount of choline in a single egg to how much broccoli you would need to meet that. It's like 4 cups of broccoli.
Yeah.
How much cooked beans you would need. It's like 2 cups of cooked beans to meet the amount of choline in a single egg. So the foods I have on that graphic are some of the richest plant sources of choline. And to this day, I've still never seen a vegan meal plan. Certainly I've seen a vegetarian one, as I said, but I've never seen a vegan meal plan that contains sufficient amounts of choline. It doesn't even meet the recommended intake of choline, which for pregnancy is 450 milligrams. But on top of that, you open up a whole other can of worms when you start looking at the more recent research on choline, which has examined higher choline intakes in pregnancy versus ones that are adequate. So they give 930 milligrams of choline per day versus 480 milligrams of choline. So even the low choline group is exceeding the recommended intake. And then you look at how the kids fare. So this study has now been extended into, the kids are now 7 years old. At all time points, they have tested them. The kids show signs of better brain development, things like reaction time, attention span, in the group that were exposed to the 930 milligrams of choline per day. And this held true regardless of what the kids ate, how they were fed as babies, what they ate through infancy, toddlerhood, and later childhood. You start opening a lot of cans of worms. It's one thing to just look at like, okay, can we meet the RDA for this? Can we take a higher quality prenatal vitamin or an algae-based DHA supplement or additional fill-in-the-blank nutrient? And then we're good. We met 100% of the RDA and everything's fine. When you start looking at some of this newer research showing that, oops, actually the requirements for this nutrient should be more than double what they currently are, or vitamin B12 actually needs to be at least triple what the RDA is to provide enough for pregnancy and lactation, then you start to run into a lot of tricky situations. Even more, like, take it a step further, you start looking at the amino acid requirements. So protein requirements for pregnancy are much higher than previously thought, 73% higher than we previously thought they are. Sure, yes, you can meet those protein requirements creatively on a vegan diet, but you start looking at the individual amino acids. And, oh, look, there's a role for all of these so-called non-essential amino acids for optimal maternal health and fetal development. So you go into the glycine and the carnitine and the taurine and the proline. And I cover a lot of these in an article on my website on protein requirements in pregnancy for people who want to read more. And I also have a lot of research briefs on my Instagram page on some of these individual amino acids. But you start looking into those. Many of those are either solely or only found in animal foods or are more concentrated in animal foods. And you can start running into some issues. So vegetarian diet, doable. And in Real Food for Pregnancy, I do cover, nutrients of concern on a vegetarian diet and then tips for optimizing it if you choose to do it that way. There might be a couple little holes that could be filled in with supplementation, or sometimes people are willing to bend the rules just a little bit. They might incorporate like a marine collagen supplement to get enough glycine and proline, or they might incorporate like an organ meat capsule or oysters. Some vegans actually will eat oysters because they don't have a central nervous system and don't feel pain. But oysters are highly concentrated in a lot of the different nutrients that are usually lacking on a vegan diet, including iron, zinc, copper, B12, DHA, selenium, iodine. So sometimes people do that. There's even desiccated oyster supplements now in the market. So sometimes people are willing to bend the rules a little bit. And I think that would make probably the most sense if you're going to like go that route. You do a high quality prenatal vitamin, you do your DHA, you do your choline, and maybe you're supplementing in with some of these other actual like supplemental food sources. That would be like crossing your T's and dotting your I's. But that does like bend the rules. So, you know, you have to kind of decide like what is the motivating factor behind eating the way you are, and how comfortable are you with bending those rules in order to get optimal levels of nutrition. And that's a different answer for every person. I just think that for me, what I've observed with a lot of the vegetarian and vegan resources is they don't even broach these topics. It's just, it's a can of worms, I tell you. Yeah. And they don't want to go there. It's uncomfortable. It makes you challenge everything you think you thought you knew about nutrition or your worldview. And so it's a really tricky subject.
Mm. I mean, so huge. And I'm very grateful that you even are willing to touch on it, because I know, again, that just, it can trigger a lot of people. But just talking nutrients, you know, it's important to understand. It's important to start to just talk about these topics more. And you did touch on oysters, and I want to touch a little bit on the foods that we're supposed to quote unquote avoid. So oysters cooked then versus raw? Are we not supposed to have sushi? Like, I think understanding, what are we allowed to have? Deli meats. Like, the only thing we're told going into pregnancy is all the things to avoid, not really all the things to have.
Exactly. And that's another perfect example of another pet peeve of mine, because they really do focus so much on what to avoid and not on what to emphasize. Like, we aren't given, or at least I wasn't given, like, here are the things you want to eat more of to have a healthier pregnancy. It was like, these foods can make you sick, don't eat them. And it's okay. So people enter into pregnancy with all of these outrageous fears around around foods, and a lot of them are actually unfounded. So foods to avoid, again, another can of worms. So usually things are on a food to avoid list due to concerns about foodborne illness. So getting food poisoning, essentially. There are some other examples specific to, you know, the liver one with vitamin A is another example, although there's sometimes a food safety concern with that as well, which we can talk about if you want. And then the heavy metals in certain types of fish. Mm-hmm. That's another one that commonly comes up. The rest of them are really related to the risk of being contaminated with harmful bacteria or other, you know, pathogens that could cause foodborne illness. Now, when you start to unpack which foods are on this list and why they're on this list, and then the relative risk of how likely are you to get sick with said pathogen from eating those foods during pregnancy, then it gets kind of interesting. So examples of things that are on the list would be like soft cheeses. Data estimates that there's one case of Listeria infection per 5 million servings of soft cheese consumed by pregnant women. So, I mean, does that weigh into your choice to eat soft cheese or not? I mean, it's a pretty minimal risk for, you know, deli meat. The estimate is one case of Listeria infection per 83,000 servings of deli meat consumed by pregnant women.
Wow.
Okay. Pretty low.
Yeah.
You know, you can absolutely like choose hard cheeses and, you know, that lowers the risk even more, but 1 in 5 million, not that much. Okay. with the deli meat, you know, deli meat isn't like necessarily filling in major nutrient gaps in the diet unless that's like the only source of animal protein that you're consuming. And in that case, it very well could be a really important source of B12 and iron and zinc and other nutrients for you, right? But you could choose to not eat deli meat. You can heat the deli meat before consuming. You can choose to just eat it anyways because that risk is really low. But that's ultimately, I believe that's up to you. It's not the risk, in my opinion, has been like way overblown on those. Eggs with runny yolks is another example. You know, don't eat undercooked eggs. The risk there is contamination with salmonella. The estimated odds that an egg contains salmonella is anywhere from 1 in 12,000 to 1 in 30,000 eggs.
Wow.
And then if you look at eggs from chickens that are raised via like organic methods or on pasture, that risk is sevenfold lower than the stats I already quoted. Mm. So think of how many eggs you might eat over the course of a pregnancy.
Yeah.
Very, very unlikely that you'd even come in contact with one egg that's contaminated. Now, you could make the choice to, the worst one, not eat eggs at all, which I actually see this a lot, and it saddens me.
Yeah.
A lot of women avoid eggs entirely, going for like oatmeal or cereal because it seems like a safer choice. Mm-hmm. Ironically, you're like massively spiking your blood sugar, eating significantly less protein, unless you're making up for it in other ways, and have a lower micronutrient intake, which has its own set of considerations, right? The other option is cooking it until the yolks are solid. If you enjoy your eggs that way, really no problem there. But if you enjoy your eggs, you know, over easy or over medium like I do, and you'd be eating a heck of a lot less eggs if you couldn't have them the way that you enjoy, what's the trade-off nutritionally, you know? So just food for thought. I don't tell anybody what to do. I just want people to like think about this because I feel like women especially are, it's very patronizing the way that information about pregnancy nutrition is given out to us. It's like this list of rules that are very arbitrary, don't necessarily make sense. And there's no room for conversation around it. Like we're not dumb, you know, like stop. The question on sushi, I don't have stats on like the rates of foodborne illness related to sushi, but I do find it interesting that in other countries, sushi is not necessarily off limits, and that includes raw fish. Like in Japan, it's actually encouraged. Huh. Even in the UK, the NHS guidelines do not warn against raw fish consumption from sushi because of the quality standards that go into sushi-grade fish and the fact that they have been flash frozen and kept frozen for long enough that any potential parasites or other things would have been killed from the long-term freezing. So that's a matter of handling. Like how safe is, how was the fish stored in the establishment that you're buying it from? Was it kept cold? Has it been sitting out forever? It's a matter of contamination there. As far as oysters and shellfish, so that one is technically a bit more tricky. So although seafood-associated foodborne illness infections are not that common, it's only like a couple percent of the total amount of food poisoning cases in the U.S. Of those that are related to seafood, 75% are from raw or undercooked shellfish. And so, again, for that one, I think it comes down to handling. Mm-hmm. So I know people who live, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, they like harvest their own oysters or buy them right from the, you know, fishmonger who gathered them that morning and they're eating them that afternoon. And it's like super fresh. I'm not going to tell you not to eat your fresh oysters. Yes, there's always going to be a risk of contamination there. If you're not really 100% certain on the quality of the oysters, you might be better off going for cooked. Mm-hmm. But also with anything, there's a risk of food poisoning. So 46% of food poisoning cases in the U.S. are from raw fruits and vegetables. And so there's no guidance in pregnancy to avoid salads or fresh fruit. And not even the pre-cut vegetables and fruit at the grocery store. If you're going to be particular about anything, I would avoid those. Mm. The pre-cut fruits and vegetables are almost, they are one of the most commonly cited sources of food poisoning outbreaks. That and like salad bars, eating out at restaurants, especially establishments that don't have really good, you know, food safety standards. So those would be things that I'd be more concerned about. I'd be more worried about being at like a summer barbecue and the salad with fresh cut up fruit and spinach and stuff has been sitting out for like 4 hours and it's 90 degrees outside. I'd be more concerned about that than I would about sushi from like a really nice sushi restaurant. But that's just me. You know, your nose becomes very attuned during pregnancy. And if something is off, usually you'll either not be able to even be around it, let alone eat it, or you'll spit it out immediately. At least that was the case for me. Like, I enjoyed deli meats during my pregnancy, for example. And the first day that I opened up the salami and maybe the second day, I could eat it. And by day three, I like literally could not eat it. Mm-hmm. Was it contaminated? Mm-hmm. Probably not. But something about it, the fact that it had been open for 3 days, I was like, I can't eat this. Like, give it to my husband to eat it. If a salad had like a single, you know, mushy green in it that had like gone bad, it was like the whole salad, like just could not get it down the hatch. Like, I just can't eat this anymore. So also like trust your instincts, you know? Yeah.
That's a really cool, I think like evolutionary safeguard that, that we have inside of us that helps mothers sniff out those things. Like, oh, I don't think I'm going to go for this one, but Lily, thank you so much. This has been all such incredible information, and I know you have so much more that people can dive into. You've mentioned your blog. If you go check out Lily Nichols RDN on Instagram, the books that we mentioned throughout, we'll have all of those linked up below in the show notes. Is there anywhere else that people can go to continue to learn from you?
Well, those would be some of the top sources. So the books and my blog, those are both linked on my main website, lilynicholsrdn.com. I do also have professional level webinars. So these are webinars geared towards practitioners over at the Women's Health Nutrition Academy. It's also linked out from my main website, I believe under the services tab. So if you wanted to get, you know, we have like a 2-hour webinar on folate going into all of the controversy and ins and outs of folate metabolism and folate versus folic acid. Related to pregnancy and fertility, right? There's, you know, a webinar on gestational diabetes. There's so many. The postpartum recovery ones and nutrient repletion and the nutrition for breastfeeding focused on nutrient transfer into breast milk. Those are some of like the more popular ones. So I do try to make my blog and free resources as available as possible. I mean, really, I put most of my stuff out for free. But I do also have some other higher end resources there, and there will be more to come.
Definitely so many resources. Your blogs are really incredible, and your books. So, I mean, just appreciate all you're doing and all you're helping for women to actually start to understand their bodies during this crazy time and this new phase in life. So I just deeply appreciate the research you're doing, the work that you're doing, and thank you so much for taking the time to be here today.
so much great information that we could have just continued to dig into with Lily. So if you loved what she was saying, go check her out at the resources that we're linking below. And also, if you've been loving and listening to our podcast, please consider going to your favorite podcasting platform, subscribing, leaving us a rating and review, and even sharing it with a friend. That's just going to continue to help this incredible information get out to more people. And of course, if you want to support us, go join that Barefoot mini course. You're also going to get a 25% code special for joining the Barefoot mini course now. So go check that out. It's the last day to get in. And of course, we'll see you next time on the Optimal Body Podcast.